Church Going by Philip Larkin. Once I am sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church, matting, seats in stone, and little books, sprawlings of flowers, cut for Sunday, brownish now. Some brass and stuff up at the holy end, the small neat organ, in a tense, musty, unignorable silence, brewed God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new, cleaned or restored. Someone would know. I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring, large-scale verses, and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book. Donate an Irish sixpence. Reflect, the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did, in fact I often do, and always end much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for. Wondering, too, when churches fall completely out of use, what should we turn them into? If we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment, plate, and picks in locked cases, and let the rest rent-free to rain and sheep? Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or after dark, will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night, see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on, in games, in riddles, seemingly at random, but superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky. A shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rude lofts were? Some ruin-biber randy for antique, or Christmas addict counting on a whiff of gown and bands and organ pipes and myrrh? Or will he be my representative, bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub, because it held unspilt so long and equably what since is found only in separation, marriage, and birth, and death, and thoughts of these? For whom was built this special shell? For though I have no idea what this accoutred frosty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house, on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized, and robed as destinies. And that much can never be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round. Welcome to the Bellatrist Podcast. I'm Dave Stevens. Today I read another of my favorite poems, Church Going by Philip Larkin. Larkin was a post-World War II English poet and novelist. His first work was published in 1945. Church-going is probably his most loved poem, but his most infamous poem is undoubtedly This Be the Verse, published in 1971, the first lines of which are, "They fuck you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do." This created a bit of a scandal at the time, and apparently as a result he fell out of fashion within the family values side of the aisle, within the UK, most notably with Margaret Thatcher, who reportedly was an admirer of Larkin's before that verse was published. Larkin is an interesting character and an agonizing example of how it's quite possible to think very little of an author personally while still being deeply affected by his or her work. It's hard, actually, once you learn a bit about the man, for the word pathetic to not stubbornly cling to his reputation in one's mind. If you feel like being depressed and mildly nauseated by a description of this aspect of Larkin's life, I recommend the article Loving Philip Larkin by the late, great Christopher Hitchens, who was, incidentally, a huge fan of this poem, which may surprise you given his reputation as one of the most formidable atheists to ever live. If you know Hitchens, you'll know that when he wants to make a point, he can drive it into your brain like a 10-penny nail with a sledgehammer. Listen to this quotation from the article I've just mentioned on the environment that produced Larkin's particular form of pessimism and cynicism. "This is the world of wretched, tasteless food and watery drinks, dreary and crowded lodgings, outrageous plumbing, surly cynicism, long queues, shocking hygiene, and dismal rain-lashed holidays continually punctuated by rudeness and Philistinism." Postwar Britain sounds awesome, right? So let's just say that Larkin might have had some environmental reasons for his lack of sentiment. His other character flaws, however, I don't think can be blamed on culture or environment. Incidentally, I noticed while looking up the quotation that the entire article by Hitchens is available on YouTube under the title "Philip Larkin, Christopher Hitchens, quote, arguably, unquote." I'm not entirely sure if this has been done with the permission of The Atlantic or the publisher of his anthology, but it is there if you care to look it up. Having said all this, an important lesson to learn about poetry, or literature in general, is that poems or other forms of literature should at most often be read without regard for the author or their intent. There are some exceptions to this, but for the most part, the text is what it is, regardless of whether or not the author intended it to be that way. Many authors, philosophers, and theorists have, for centuries, described the act of artistic creation as one in which the artist is merely the medium through which something is born. If you're interested in this concept, there's an outstanding TED Talk by Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of the best-selling novel Eat, Pray, Love, in which she explores the trope of the artist as a conduit for a muse rather than the author of a piece. You can Google it. It's called "Your Elusive Creative Genius," and I highly recommend it. In it, she essentially argues that your work is not you. It's like your child. And just like a parent, you're necessary for the creation of your child. But if your child turns out to be a psychopath, you don't get to negate that fact by loudly asserting, "Actually, you're misinterpreting her. I meant for her to be loving, kind, and empathetic." Well, sorry, dude, she's still out in the backyard torturing squirrels. So, also, of course, if your child becomes the next Stephen Hawking or Shakespeare, you don't get to take credit for that. So, anyway, forget the author, and let's take a look at church-going outside of Larkin's rather pathetic wheezing shadow, because it is a piece worth looking at closely. As you'll no doubt have already intuited, poetry isn't exactly plot-driven. What's the plot summary of this poem? A man's riding a bicycle and stops in an old church, wanders around, thinks a bit, then leaves. Not quite the plot of Star Wars, is it? Popular media has made us all emotional diabetics. We have no patience today for the introspective, the long look that produces defamiliarization. Most of us exist on a sugar-high junk food diet of reality TV, Twitter feeds, and superhero movies that deliver a constant barrage of intense stimulation with no real nutrition for our minds and souls. How long has it been since you last looked at the screen of your cell phone? If you're like most people, less than a handful of minutes. And this is the point, or at least part of the point of this poem. It's an exploration of how the serious, quiet contemplation of existence, and a sense of that which is holy or sacred, might still be worthy of our attention in a world after belief and beyond disbelief. And this is the important bit, beyond disbelief. What's that all about? If you're a fan of Jordan Peterson and his argument regarding the role of mythological stories, or if you've ever listened to Brett Weinstein discuss the adaptive advantages of religion, then this element of the poem should appeal to you. In essence, Larkin was exploring, using far fewer words, the same landscape as these two scientists. The first three stanzas of the poem are fairly straightforward. The speaker stops at a church while riding a bike. It's clear from the third stanza that he's not a believer himself, as he wonders what churches will be used for when everyone has essentially come to their senses and not given into superstition. At the end of the fourth stanza, however, the speaker states, "Superstition, like belief, must die, and what remains when disbelief has gone?" And this is where the poem begins to be worthy of serious attention. He does not say, "What remains when belief has gone?" He says, "What remains when disbelief has gone?" That's not a typo. In poems like this, single words that seem to be out of place are not accidents, and we need to ask, why are they present? In the next stanza, the speaker has two of my favorite lines, which incidentally, have come to symbolize the university in my mind whenever I read this poem now. A shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. What is the shape and purpose? What's the purpose of religion? It's an interesting inversion of the default form of this question, isn't it? If religion's literally true, it wasn't created in the sense that it was designed. It was a response to a pre-existing condition. God existed, and we started talking about him, and that's religion, in the literal sense. Just like mountains and sedimentary layers existed, and we started studying them, and that's how we got geology. We don't ask, for what purpose did we create geology, as if mountains and ancient layers of the earth were byproducts of our academic creation. But this inversion is in response to the query, what remains when disbelief has gone? So we've arguably an implicit acknowledgement that belief in religion was designed by man to achieve worldly goals when, quote, superstition like belief dies. If that happens, then you're a disbeliever. What does the speaker mean in his implicit assumption that disbelief will go just like belief did? Well, we find the answer to this question in the second to the last stanza, in which the speaker describes his representative, someone who has come to the church bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub, because it held unspilt so long and equably, what since is found only in separation, marriage, and birth, and death. Let's break this down. You don't know really why you've wandered into this space, this church. Some obscure impulse draws you here. You know that the, quote, ghostly silt has been dispersed. What does that mean? It means that the mystical, the literal belief in the supernatural, has left this place. The presence of spirits and the potency of incense, holy water, the communion wafer, has been reduced to the mere symbolic elements of a cultural ceremony. But still, you're here, and it pleases me to stand in silence here. Why is that? What is worthy of our attention in this pregnant silence of an empty church? Why is the speaker drawn here? The final stanza, one of the finest to be found anywhere, in my opinion, gives us the answer. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized, and robed as destinies. I love these lines. They seem to capture the obscure complexity of ritual and ancient tradition, and the feeling of being a participant in a line of heritage and history and culture that is occasionally tangible in ceremony and sacred places, but defy casual or denotative explanation. While here, the speaker says, our collective compulsions are recognized and then robed as destinies, which means we see our aspirations, perhaps to be wiser, kinder, take on more responsibility, all the intangible qualities which we do not sufficiently possess, but to which we rarely give voice. And somehow in this space, they are known. And more than that, the collective gravitas of the space makes us feel destined to achieve them. The poem concludes, and that much can never be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie around. There's a lot to unpack in those few short lines, but I particularly love the line, someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious. I always remember a certain moment just after my daughter was born when I read this line. She was sitting in my lap and we were just sort of looking at each other. She must have been about a month old. And there was this moment of recognition, as if we really saw each other for the first time. Like, oh, you're my dad. And I was like, oh, there you are. And suddenly, I wasn't a child anymore. Adulthood hit me like a train, and I was surprised to find a deep well of need to be serious in all the ways that my childhood self had once taken for granted or even scorned. This is the point of the poem. It's about recognizing that beyond disbelief, the need for a recognition of the sacred, the holy, is still vital. So, I hope you enjoyed reading the poem, and we'll come back to it from time to time. This is one that gets better with age and rereading. And remember, don't let anyone tell you that ranking one bit of literature superior to another is just opinion, and that everyone's opinion is equally valid. That's horseshit. Both ideas are examples of that peculiar form of modern cleverness that's indistinguishable from abject stupidity. Of course some literature is bad, some good, and some great. And just because one cannot distinguish between them in a punchline doesn't mean that the distinction does not exist. It takes work to figure this out. And like all hard work in a worthy cause, the payoff is far greater than the effort to achieve it. The purpose of literature is not to save your soul. It is to make your soul worth saving. See you next podcast. And now, here's the poem one more time. Church Going by Philip Larkin. Once I am sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church, matting, seats in stone, and little books, sprawlings of flowers, cut for Sunday, brownish now. Some brass and stuff up at the holy end, the small, neat organ, in a tense, musty, unignorable silence, brewed God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new, cleaned or restored. Someone would know. I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring, large-scale verses and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book. Donate an Irish sixpence. Reflect, the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did, in fact I often do, and always end much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for, wondering too, when churches fall completely out of use, what should we turn them into, if we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment, plate and picks and locked cases, and let the rest rent-free to rain and sheep? Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or after dark, will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on, in games, in riddles, seemingly at random, but superstition, like belief, must die. And what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky. A shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rude lofts were? Some ruin-biber randy for antique, or Christmas addict counting on a whiff of gown and bands and organ pipes and myrrh? Or will he be my representative, bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub, because it held unspilt so long and equably what since is found only in separation, marriage, and birth, and death, and thoughts of these? For whom was built this special shell? For though I have no idea what this accoutred frosty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house. On serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized and robed as destinies. And that much can never be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round.